Hey guys, welcome to this week's Money and Investing Show. This week we are talking about international markets. This is an area that so many investors shun away from, perceiving it as being more difficult or maybe not tax friendly or indeed logistically quite challenging. It doesn't have to be that way. Make sure you go through this podcast and take plenty of notes, but most importantly, make sure you take plenty of action. Hey guys, welcome to this week's Money and Investing Show with me, your host, Andrew Baxter, and as always, my off-sider and co-host, Mitchell Laurentia.
Get out of town, AB, literally today, because we're going to be talking about international markets. How's that for a segue?
It is terrible. It's entry level, but that's good. You're growing slowly.
Yeah, that's right. It is what it is. Today, getting onto the matter at hand, we're going to be talking about investing outside of our local market. A lot of investors probably don't realize there are so many more opportunities out there abroad. You just got to know how to do it.
Indeed, there is a world of opportunity out there. And when you look at the traditional financial planning model, for example, if you have a exposure to the stock market through a financial planner, they'll probably go, oh, we'll have 60% Aussie exposure. It's nice and low risk and a bit of 40% overseas, which, you know, when you consider Australia is about, 2% of the world economy, or certainly less than 2% of the global stock exchange, gives you this colossal overweight position towards a very, very small market. Versus, you know, a lack of exposure to some of the other opportunities that sit there. And I think you'd almost argue the inverse would be a better way to go. And maybe at the end of this podcast, the listeners might think the same.
Oh, yeah. Well, I know firsthand, anecdotally speaking, with our trading here at AIE, so many more of our recommendations in the US versus Australia, better liquidity, better options, more stocks to trade. It just makes sense from that perspective.
Look, it does. I mean, the US equity market is 50, 60% of the global economy or global stock markets. The US is such a behemoth economy. And how can you have a portfolio of shares where you don't have any exposure to the Magnificent Seven in the tech sector, for example, or some of the other huge global brands? You know, look at the pharmaceutical industries as an example. The global banking industry is another example. Entertainment giants like Disney or Netflix. And instead, I've got exposure to 10 or 7 or whatever it might be, which is, you know, a couple hundred thousand people a day watch it.
That's right. Let's talk about international markets, and we might get into the topic of emerging markets specifically as well, AB, in a moment's time. What kind of markets out there are widely available for investors to trade? Which ones would you suggest maybe having a look at?
No, I think the bigger markets make an awful lot of sense. And we've talked already to the US, and I think the US is, you know, it's been where I do pretty much all of my investing, as I have for a few years now, purely and simply because of its sheer scale. The fact that it is the global engine room, in spite of what some people may feel, is a great place to start. Being from the UK originally, I still have a soft spot for UK investments, but I haven't traded a UK stock for a really long time, even though I know a lot about the companies and what they do. It's in the wrong time zone for me, but it's also, yeah, it's just my interest is more focused toward the US. And I think as Australians, we're quite close to the US in terms of the news flow that we see here. And also, I think the attitude's a little bit different to what it was back in the day when we were more, I guess, orientated around the Commonwealth. So, you know, the big markets around the world would be obviously the US, the UK, which is the FTSE 100, the top 100 companies in the UK, the DAX in Germany, although given the fact that now we look at Europe as a broader economic community, you could look at the Euro Stoxx 50, which would give you the top 50 companies in Europe. Japan, which, you know, is still up there in the world's top 5 economies, would be the sort of major spots. And of course, China now too, insofar as, you know, it's such a huge economy. But how do you invest in those to make it easy? And having a brokerage account in some of those countries could be quite challenging. I guess the fortunate thing on our platform, we can trade, you know, 40, 50 markets globally from one platform that's based here in Australia, in Australian dollars, I might add. So, you know, that's made it an awful lot easier for people to get exposure to that. And I don't think investors should be shy of having that overseas exposure either. You know, to the other side of the argument, you hear, oh, there's exchange rate risk. You've got to be careful with that. And well, yes, there is. And the biggest exchange rate risk is that you hold a currency like the Aussie, which on a decline in resource prices means that your Aussie dollar buys very little elsewhere around the world. Whereas if you've got overseas investments, you know, you can benefit from, you know, some fortitude in the currencies of those countries.
That's right. And I think the familiarity for most people too is really gaining because, let's face it, you watch Channel 9 in the morning, you're hearing a lot about Meta and international companies, not necessarily our local companies. To move forward from that, AB, and I know this is a growing area of interest for you specifically in your trading, and that's not necessarily international markets, but emerging markets specifically. Can you talk to us about what that means specifically and what it looks like?
Look, emerging markets would be, it's hard to say this without it sounding slightly condescending. oftentimes not third world countries, but countries that are coming out of being of a more impoverished background into a more Western lifestyle or wealth level. To give you some examples of this, so dear friend of mine back in the day, a guy called Nicholas Vardy, used to run a fund, Central and Eastern European Fund, back in the 1990s. Great fund manager, Nick, and a good character too, I might add. And Central and Eastern Europe was coming out of the doldrums of being part of the sort of Soviet communist era. And those countries like Latvia or Poland or the Czech Republic were all starting to become closely tied to the European Union, or indeed joining the European Union. So there was this enormous shift from being communist and grey and centrally governed to this colourful world of opportunity created by the West. And Nick was quite instrumental in investing in a lot of those countries, Russia included at the time too, I might add. And there was a lot of money to be made because, you know, you've got countries, I beg your pardon, companies that, you know, take Plevo, which is a drug company in Central Eastern Europe, no one would have heard of. And then all of a sudden, it's a major manufacturer of pharmaceutical drugs as it's got access to capital and access to new markets. And if you invest in those companies early on, you know, you can do especially well. So that's a very good example of that sort of process. And now if you look at it, those markets are more fully valued because they're not new or emerging markets, they're well established. And so the hunt then goes for, well, where's next? What are the next places to look at investing and where the opportunities might sit? So, you know, to an extent, you could argue on some metrics that China may be included in those, other metrics not. You know, countries like India or Mexico or other countries in South America, which, you know, have vast resources, like Brazil, for example, it's a huge exporter of iron ore, could create, you know, good opportunities. The flip side is with opportunity, there's always a challenge. And some of those countries don't necessarily have the most stable government. They have high levels of inflation. Interest rates move around. And so there are variables that you have to traverse if you're an investor in those countries that perhaps you don't have to if you're investing in your Magnificent Seven NASDAQ listed stocks in the US. So there's a very different landscape and playing field for them, but gee, they can provide some really incredible opportunities for investment. And I think more than anything, Mitch, the reason why those markets appeal is that their performance is usually quite uncorrelated to the traditional markets. And so it gives you a great level of diversification. So if the Dow is having a hard time, you know, and we went through the specter of rising interest rates over the last sort of 2 years in the US, and perhaps we're getting toward the end of that tunnel now. At the same vein, you had a lot of countries in the Far East, for example, where interest rates weren't going up because they didn't have an inflationary problem. And so their stock markets were doing, you know, especially well through those timeframes. So that diversification is a huge attribute. You're never going to put all your eggs in that market space because it is typically more volatile, but certainly embracing and having some exposure, I think is a very, very sensible thing to do as an investor if you're serious about working your portfolio hard.
Absolutely, indeed. Now, before we go into some maybe trades or investments you've made in that space, AB, one thing that springs to my mind as a question is tax considerations and regulatory issues. Now, I know if you're investing offshore, there's obviously a potentially tax implications of that, but a good thing is a lot of these ETFs, which we trade often in the emerging market space, are issued in the US, which we've got a dual tax treaty with.
Exactly right. And it creates an opportunity to go to a sort of one-shop stop where you don't have to dive in deep and work out which company in a certain economy is going to do really well and others not. You can simply invest in an ETF where it might be tracking the index in that country. It gives you wonderful diversification. Also, it gives you just one transaction to do, but to get, you know, a bulk allocation, if you will, or exposure to a lot of different shares. The tax side of it does become interesting. And you're right, we do have a dual tax treaty with, for example, the US. And so one of the services that we provide for our clients, there's a form, it's a W-8-BEN form, which is not the easiest.
I love those forms. Used to anyway.
Look, I haven't looked at one for an awful long time, but they're written by the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service in the US. They're not exactly user-friendly. And we get our clients to complete one of those. We help them do that. And then all of a sudden, your tax liability in the US is effectively zero. It's all paid here in Australia, making it far easier to then trade and invest in those markets without that sort of fear. Equally, as you say, legislation and compliance can be quite challenging too, especially if you're operating in some of the less beaten paths. Yeah, we talked about, you know, Japan, which very clearly isn't an emerging market, or Germany, which very clearly isn't, or the UK. So they're very well established. But if you wanted to hold, you know, Thai equities, for example, and the actual, you know, the Bangkok Stock Exchange been around for a long, long time. It's actually a pretty orderly and very well run market, but it's off the beaten track for most investors, which makes it a little bit more challenging in terms of where to get your research from, how to get a bead on the economics in that country.
But long story short is you don't have to open an account overseas with an overseas broker.
Just open it with us here in Australia, Australian dollar held account, all your tech stuff taken care of, very, very easy. And as I say, access to multiple markets around the world, very, indeed, very simple.
So to get to the nitty gritty of this, maybe some of your trades that you've made, and we can talk ETF specific, given that's your area of expertise.
Yeah, look, if I look to views and opportunities, there's probably three good case studies over the last sort of 18 months that we could take a look at.
Hit us. Don't leave us sitting here any longer.
And there's a really interesting story behind all of them. And I'll start with Mexico. And Mexico is an incredibly interesting country. If you ever spend any time there, it's a pretty wild place too.
Oh, yeah.
It has its challenges safety-wise sometimes, but nonetheless, it is an interesting place, as is most of South America. It's a really cool culture. Mexico is in a very enviable position insofar as what we saw in the post-COVID world, and particularly when events such as the Suez Canal became blocked, or other countries went into a more harsh regime of lockdown through the pandemic. It really strained a lot of supply chains, particularly for big multinational companies in the US. And you think, well, you know, you're dealing with these countries all around the world because you've got access to cheaper labor. It's a lower unit cost for manufacturing your goods. But if you can't get the goods and sell them, it's going to hit your bottom line. And that sort of bell went off, I think, for a lot of companies. And this notion now of nearshoring, where you move to markets or economies that are closer to you, where you don't have to, you know, ship things around the world and deal with the potential risk of tariffs and things of that nature, make Mexico quite interesting. If you think about its location, it's in the same time zone as the US. So you haven't got to get up in the middle of the night to have a Zoom with a factory in Asia to say, where's my stuff? It's Chinese New Year, or, you know, the Suez Canal's blocked, so we can't put on a boat, get it to you. It's in the same landmass that you are. And the US, and I guess no political pun meant by this, effectively does have an open border with Mexico. But from a trade perspective, it certainly does with the NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement. So you've got this ability to be able to move your stuff in and out very, very easily without the risk of tariff, in the same time zone, without needing to put on a boat. And they're things that are, you know, pretty advantageous. Couple that with reasonably high skilled, cheap labor. And I'm going to say at the lower manufacturing end, not necessarily at the really high spec end, but certainly at the lower and mid manufacturing end, no brainer. And that's one of the things that you start to see in the Mexican ETF, which is a great way of getting a broad diversification to that. EEWU has had a fantastic run on the back of that particular narrative. So there's an example of seeing what's going on in the world, trying to get a bead on how companies are digesting what's going on in the world and where they foresee that game being played out going forward. So Mexico is a good example of that. India would be a second one. India is an incredibly interesting country. My grandfather lived there actually in the 1930s. He was there in the British Army.
Wow. Okay.
When he was a soldier, and fascinating country. And if you look at what's going on in India right now, it's the world's biggest democracy. It's going to election this year, and you've had a mandate where you've got around 300 million people that exist on less than $5 a day, which, you know, is obviously a tough ask. It's also got more millionaires than any other country in the world too, which,
really,
is an interesting sort of dichotomy.
Very surprising.
And some of the economic policy afoot at the moment is that ability to take people from abject poverty, particularly in rural areas, and bring them industrially, as we've seen in China, for example, and also just generally an evolution and high level of sophistication in the economy. So you've got 300 million people whose income is going to jump from, well, it's hardly a jump, but from $5 a day to $10 a day, which is nothing still in the big scheme of things, but it's massive in terms of the quantum, what that impact of doubling of income. And so that's at the heart of that play. But also you look at India from a cell phone perspective. So India will be the world's largest cell phone market in the next 2 years. And I'm not talking about high-spec iPhone, just a basic cheap phone. So you've got this huge market that's coming online that currently hasn't been online or hasn't had access to be online through telecommunications and technology. Again, a huge springboard for that particular country. So how do you invest in it? Pretty tricky. And you've got companies like Reliance, which at one point a few months ago looked like it was about to go under, and then it's not. And so stock selection is quite hard. Again, pick up an ETF, PIN as an example of an exchange traded fund traded in the US, but on Indian equities, making it very easy to transact. Your tax is all sorted out with the US, as we've already covered, and you've got the ability to have exposure to this once in a generation wealth explosion that's going on in that country.
Indeed.
And the final one, a little bit more sophisticated, perhaps. If you take China, no, China's not an emerging market per se, but if you've got a view that it's going to be struggling on the back of the collapse of Evergrande and the bad debt that's through there, and it's not just the company that's gone under, but it's also the tax revenue that's going to impact quite dramatically, I think, on a lot of local authorities there that make their money from property transactions, demand for steel, and the knock-on effects of the wealth implosion of people that have paid a deposit or a bond to buy an apartment that they're not going to get. That's going to weigh pretty heavily. And we've already seen in China, there's been a slowdown in spending. People are saving a lot more. There's also higher levels, particularly in younger people, of unemployment and a lower consumer confidence on the back of it. And so you think none of that really particularly augurs well for the Chinese equities market. So how can you profit from that? And again, you know, finding stocks to short and trade in China can be quite challenging.
Oh, yeah.
Again, there's an ETF for it, Yang, Y-A-N-G.
Oh, that's clever, isn't it?
Very clever. And that's the bearish geared ETF on Chinese equity.
So is there a yin?
There is a yin as well, which is the bullish ETF. Yeah, so you can do yin and yang and be neutral, or you can take a view either white or black, light or dark, and go from there. And so there's an example where you can exploit, and I use that term carefully, the movement or anticipated movement you expect to see in that economy as it perhaps does go into a recession and equity markets suffer on the back of it. So three very, very different case studies based on different drivers. And I think it highlights the importance. And don't get me wrong, any one of those three, they're going to be a very, very small position in your portfolio because they're aggressive and they're quite niche. And really, the big position in your portfolio ought to be in the blooming NASDAQ or S&P because, I mean, they're two markets that, you know, last year the S&P put on 20%, the NASDAQ 42%. This year to date, what are we looking at? Sort of about 6 and 8% respectively year to date for those two indices. And if you just picked up an index tracking ETF, you'd be going pretty damn well and then have a little bit of color around the fringes in some of these emerging market stories, if that's something that floats your boat, or in some UK or Japanese or European equities. Well, that gives you a little bit of a diversified portfolio of bonds as well. And it just takes people out of that lane of, you know, top 20 Aussie companies, which, you know, we're the best one in the world. Yeah, we can be patriotic. A business is Australian investment education after all, but how robust is the Australian economy right now and how robust are the Australian companies within it? You know, we had the CBA and Matt Comyn come out last week saying, look, the outlook's looking a little more fragile than we'd like. And that's a stalwart of the index. You know, we've got three of the world's largest exporters of iron ore to China. And if China does go into a recession and cuts down on its steel production, given the millions of empty apartments that are sitting there right now, what does the outlook look like for our mining sector, which I might add was one of our ways of getting through the GFC? And if your portfolio is just focused on Australian equities, that's the risk that you have. And it's a substantial country risk that you're investing in a very small country, both economically and stock market, not physically, obviously, but, you know, from an economics perspective. And you've got most of your portfolio in that. Yet there's this world of opportunity that's far more diversified and potentially far more attractive in terms of an outlook that you're missing because you're anchored into your own backyard. So I think there's a huge case for international markets, for everyday people, not sophisticated investors, but everyday people to have more of an inclusion than perhaps they do right now.
Very nice. AB, thank you very much for your insight today. Cheers.
My pleasure. Anytime, Mitch. There you have it, guys. Give us a review and a rating, and we'll look forward to hosting you next week.